So welcome to the conversation that every woman should be having. I'm Maya Fisher-French, and my co-host and inspiration for this podcast is Andrea Carr. I just want to say up front that it's very important that while the series has really come about because of Andrea's experience of getting divorced, this is not just about women and divorce. This is a conversation that is actually relevant to anybody out there, especially when there are children involved. Now, we have already had a conversation with a prominent family lawyer about your marriage contract. We also spoke to a financial planner about finding financial equity in a relationship. But today we're going to focus on something perhaps we don't always feel comfortable talking about, but which is inevitable, and that is death. Really, if you are a provider and a caregiver, you need to have plans in place should something happen to you. But you also need to know what plans your spouse or your partner has. And I think that's really, Andrea, the conversation we're going to be having today.
And I'm embarrassed to sit here and admit that I have been very underprepared for this kind of conversation. And at my age, that's not acceptable anymore. I will admit, sitting here in present company, that the first time I put a hastily scribbled will together was before I climbed on an aeroplane and flew to Tanzania to climb Mount Kilimanjaro. And on the off chance I didn't come home, at least there was some signed document at home telling my kids and my spouse at the time what I wanted to do with my assets. But that was a last minute thought, literally before I climbed up a mountain. And I've gotten to the point of my life now where I realize that that is no longer sufficient. I've gone through some recent life changes, and it's time to look very seriously about how to protect myself, and mainly how to protect my children if I'm not around anymore, and to make sure that they are going to be adequately cared for with what I'm able to leave them. So what I've learned just going through some big life changes is that it's not actually acceptable to put a document in place and leave it in a safe file somewhere and never look at it again, because life changes. We go through life changes. We have children, we get married, you can do it in any order, but that document is only really relevant on the day in which you sign it. And every time you go through a big life change, you need to go back to that document and make sure that it caters for where you currently are and where you anticipate going. This is not a once-off discussion that you need to have. This is not a once-off plan, once-off document. This is a lifelong commitment to making sure that you are catering for the eventuality where you are either alone or you're not here and you've got children to look after.
And I must just tell you, my husband and I, my sons are 19 and 23 now. And 2 weeks ago, we redid our wills. We re-looked everything because now they're moving into adulthood. So you have to continuously look and review this. But I must tell you, Andrea, I know you're sitting there thinking you're a bit embarrassed about it, but you're not alone. Do you know that 3 out of 10 South Africans, only 3 out of 10 South Africans have a will? And I know from so much work that I do with Money Makeover boot camps that most parents don't have wills. So you would just think, well, you know, you've got kids to think about. And that is why we have invited Modamadi Mabule, who is a financial fiduciary expert, to give us some ideas of what should be in our wills and how we should be protecting our children and our legacy.
Thank you so much, Maya. I think I'm very excited to just share what we see out there. I mean, 3 out of 10 South Africans, coming to think of it, you know, when we conceptualize it, we throw around percentages. Oh, about 75% of South African population. But when you reduce it to that 3 out of 10, it becomes so tangible because it's not a lot. I mean, in your own circle, think about it that way. Only 3 of people actually have a will. So I'm very excited to be here and looking forward to a great conversation.
I just hope the 3 of us are the 3 that have. Or on the off chance that 2 of us aren't, what happens when you die without a will?
So there is the laws of interstate succession in South Africa. They actually, that piece of legislation dictates who's going to get what when you pass away. So I want to kill one myth. People say, if you die without a will, then everything's going to the government. No. The government has produced a law of interstate succession. Based on that, there is ways that your assets are going to be distributed. Yes, if nobody is there to inherit after 30 years, that's when it goes to the government. So let's remove that as a myth first. What does interstate succession actually mean? It means you die without having planned, you died without a will, and it dictates who's going to get what. So let's give a hypothetical scenario. You mentioned that you are divorced and you've got children. So that means now if anything happens to you and you die without a will, it will go to your children. So it becomes, you know, a straightforward thing. Children will inherit. But I must tell you, there are scenarios where people pass away. There's no children. There's no parents. And there's cousins. Where would you want your cousin to inherit from you? Maybe you might want to. Maybe it might be a cousin that you haven't spoken to in like forever. So the law actually dictates only two people are the exception that are not bloodline. The rest has to be bloodline. The exception is adopted children and also your spouse for obvious reasons. But if there isn't any, you know, it actually dictates. So I like putting it as a tree. So it's you, there's a spouse, then the spouse will get, the spouse and children, then spouse and children will get. There's no spouse, there's no children, then we look at parents, we go up. Parents are not there, then we look at siblings. Siblings are not there, we follow cousin.
Sounds so simple, doesn't it?
That's the problem, you see. So now I had someone saying to me, but I like that. I think that works. I don't need a will. And was actually, you and I were having this discussion, and it was only when I started talking to this woman and I was saying, well, you've got young children. So, I mean, I suppose technically, Andrew, you don't need a will because the money goes to your kids, but there's nothing else. There's no who's going to be the guardian, how my kids going to be looked off, who's going to get the money? That's probably a very important question. Yes.
Yeah. That's why I said then when you die interstate, you didn't plan. And that's one thing that is important. And you know, I tell people we've got doctors, we've got lawyers. Do you have a real relationship with your financial advisor? And what's the expectation? And what is that discussion between you and the financial advisor? Because that's where the planning comes in, you know. When you've got minor children, at the moment, we wake up, we go work for them, we've put the bread on the table. When you pass away, yes, they might inherit that house. Hopefully it's not a bonded house. How are they going to live? So you need to plan, have those conversations and make sure that you create enough liquidity. And I don't like just talking about liquidity as if it's something that's airy-fairy, that's far-fetched. Look at you coming to work, creating wealth now. What's going to happen if you pass away?
So my hastily scribbled will before I walked up the side of a mountain, would that have been legitimate? Would someone have been able to argue that it wasn't if it hadn't, for example, been signed or witnessed? What makes for a legitimate will?
Yes. So the Wills Act, it's actually quite clear in terms of what is a valid will. So obviously it must be written by the testator and written. We hear stories, people saying, I'll take a video quickly before I go up the mountain. No, it must be written. Okay. It must be signed correctly. Correctly meaning if you are using a thumbprint, there must be a commissioner of oath to see you do that, including witnesses. If you are able to sign, you sign in front of two competent witnesses. We get a lot of wills where quickly you go into the airport, you get your husband to sign quickly, get your daughter to sign quickly. Before you know it, they've just disinherited themselves because they've signed in your will. So they can't be. They are not competent witnesses. So it's important that you do that. Another thing that we make mistakes, you could have scribbled it. You forgot to nominate an executor. It's minor children. You didn't think about a guardian. You just thought, okay, I want my house to go to this one. I want this to, you just thought about, the some basics. Of those things, basics. And then, yes, now we've got this will. Maybe it's signed correctly. However, it missed the important parts of planning.
I mean, one of the interesting things with wills, and again, the law of interstate, is that if your child's portion goes, a child can't inherit house. They can't inherit these assets. It has to go to someone. And that's what you need to be planning for.
So Maya, the sad part, and I always say, when you go, have you seen the master's office? They do a lot of work and you can imagine the strain that they are under. There's so much unclaimed benefit. Why? Because maybe somebody doesn't know where to find these. So what happens when there's minor children and there's money and you just thought, okay, I'm not going to do a will or I just scribbled something quickly. and you didn't set up a testamentary trust for them because, you know, it was a quick action that you thought, okay, in case something happens, at least I've got something. Then what would happen? Then there's a life cover of 3 million payable to a minor child. It's going to sit in the guardian fund.
The guardian fund, let's just clarify, is run by government. And they give you a little bit of money every month, but you can imagine the administration around that.
So I think for me, I actually saw somewhere that they say they do an annual payment. So then it means the guardian will have to make sure that annual payment is split to cover those months.
It's not ideal. So if I got a chance at a redo in my life, I would certainly do things differently. And I think that comes with age and a bit of experience. What would be the most important consideration that I should be taking into account when getting married again?
Okay. I like that. I think, you know, you sit there and you're like, oh, okay. What a lot of times when we talk about marriage, you know, in my head, I go to that wedding day. I go to the bells and frills that comes with it. And then experience has taught me that you have to look at, put the bells and frills away and look at the contract. Now you're entering a contract. And what does that mean? Now we're talking legal stuff, not the airy-fairy feelings. We're talking legal stuff. Firstly, you need to understand marital regimes that are in South Africa. So in South Africa, we've got multiple marital regimes. So we've got civil marriages. In the civil marriage, we've got married in community of property. That means what is mine is and what is yours is combined in one. And then we've got marriage in out of community of property without accrual. What's yours is yours, what's mine is mine. And then we've got out of community with accrual. You came with whatever, I came with whatever. They stay separate. And then as we join together, we're going to create what is ours. So you need to know what that means. What does it mean, actually? It's all about propriety rights. And propriety rights is right of ownership. Who's owning what here? Can you see, we spoke about that wedding day and now. The consequences is actually who's going to be owning what. So it's bigger than that. So we need to apply our minds. And then we've got customary marriages in South Africa. The default system in the customary marriage is in community of property. So it works the same way as in community of property. And then we've got in terms of religious rights that are also recognized. So there is a few. And then we've got the civil union, which is for same-sex marriages. So there is a few you need to consider. And it depends on where you are at in your life. If you know you're going into business, why would you want to, you know, tag along your spouse into, you know, these kind of financial risky, you know, you'd rather separate the two. But if life has happened and you've accumulated, why would you want to bring what you've accumulated into the pot? You know, think about those things. And if you are divorced and these children, just bear in mind who's going to actually, you know, how are you going to protect your children? So your marital regime, that decision might affect even now your children.
And you've touched on something so important for me, and we've mentioned it before. When you go through big life changes, it's so easy to default into the what color shoes are we wearing to this wedding and what flowers have we got, as opposed to thinking long term. And we're not conditioned to plan for the worst. So we talk about getting married and we think this is going to last forever and this is what our lives are going to be like. But that's the point at which we need to start questioning. Does my spouse have a will? Has he recently changed his will? What does the will say? Does it leave everything to his mother, which has happened in the past?
Yes, yes.
And we're not, as humans, as I said, conditioned to think about that, but we should all be doing that.
No, absolutely. Having financial conversations with your soon-to-be spouse, very important. And we don't. People shy away from it. You know, we talk about a whole lot of other things, but when it comes to the financial conversation, we shy away from it. It's a touchy subject, but we have to. Maya mentioned, does he have a will? What's in his will? Okay, he's got a pension fund, he's employed. Who's in the beneficiary nomination form? Because a lot of times it's still the mother.
I want to ask you about that. So if now you get married, neither of you have changed your wills. You just don't get to that conversation. And perhaps there is a life cover that still is left to someone else. There's a will that's still leaving it to perhaps a mother or father. What are your rights once you get married? Is there some sort of law that kind of takes over that can supersede the will in a marriage?
Marital regime, remember I'd mentioned they talk about who's going to own what. So yes, your marital regime supersedes, right? However, there is a life cover payable to mom and married in community of property. He made a conscious decision to nominate mom. So that is going to go to mom, you know. But some of these things you can actually, you know, there's things that supersedes. Let's talk about the pension fund. If you go in your beneficiary nomination form, you still have mom, and here you are married, you've got children. The trustees of the pension fund, they look at the financial dependence. Maybe he's not supporting his mom. She's not actually a financial dependent person on him. Then, you know, we can actually look and get some form of proceeds for the children. But you don't want to sit with that dilemma where now the families are fighting over assets and you're not there to actually stipulate your intention. Your old intention we can see, but is it still relevant?
And what about testate law? How does that come to play? So if, you know, perhaps you were, and I want to get on to what we should have in a will when we have children, but say you one of you were the lesser income earners, you relied on the main provider, you've got children, but there is a will, but it's not left to perhaps the spouse. What rights does the spouse have under that? So say you married completely out of community of property, so there isn't a joint community.
So there's, I don't want to call it recourse because then it's a maintenance claim. You go and institute a maintenance claim against the estate. So we look at, you know, your will must speak to your current circumstances. He passed away, had a will when he was in varsity because there was a campaign going on in varsity. We completed a quick one. It happens to a lot of people. They do that, quickly do this, and then you forget about it. Fast forward, you've got kids down the line, so your children are going to have a maintenance claim against the estate. Your spouse is going to have a maintenance claim against the estate, and they're likely to, you know, to walk out with something. But it becomes a costly exercise because now they need to find a lawyer, they need to find an actuary who's going to quantify this claim.
And in fact, during this time, you should be mourning the passing of someone as opposed to fighting for your survival.
Absolutely. I think that, to me, is the kindest, most loving thing you can do is to put a will in place for your family. Yeah. If you love your family, which I'm assuming you do, go put a will in place for that exact reason. And talking about putting a will in place for your family, Maramadi, when you have children, we spoke about the fact that a child can't inherit an asset. The house can't go into the name of a minor child. So what should a parent do in their will to protect their children and their inheritance?
I think that, for me, it's one of the areas that when I talk to parents, the first thing I'm like, you love your children. You are the provider at the moment. Make sure that lifestyle doesn't change. I've seen scenarios where children had to, unfortunately, when the parent passed away, downgrade in a very unfortunate way because the parent didn't plan. And what does that mean? Firstly, the parent obviously had bonds and all that. And when you die, the bank wants its money. It wants its money now. Where is this money going to come from? So you need to think about it that way. I've got children. I'm planning for them. I want to leave a legacy for them. What am I leaving? Am I leaving a house? This house is still a bond on it. Who's going to pay for this bond? You start having those conversations. Okay, let's cater for the bond. Okay, at the moment, I'm the one providing for them, putting bread on the table. How are they going to have bread on the table? We quantify that. Okay. We look at their age. We look at their needs. Some of them, they go to private schools. Cater for that lifestyle because you've introduced them to that life. Cater for it. Okay, we do a calculation there. Then we look at, okay, when I've passed away, who's going to be now? I've left this money. Who's going to look after it? Because they can't get that house in their name. They can't get money in their bank account. Is it a guardian? How is this going to work? Then we've got what we call a testamentary trust. So when you do a will, you can have a testamentary trust. In your trust, you can actually dictate. I always say to people, please don't rule from the grave, but you can actually dictate. I've seen people ruling from the grave. But, you know, you want to be practical. So let's say you just want a testamentary trust that's going to make sure your children get through to varsity, get an honors degree. You know, the so-called trust fund babies, that's how it's actually created.
I don't think my kids are going to be trust fund babies, but at least we know we can finish their education.
Yes, they can finish their education. Or, you know, you leave them with something that they can actually start life and the rest is history. But that's what you want to do. So you set up a testamentary trust, you appoint a trustee. Is it going to be a guardian? Is it going to be an institution that knows what to do to make sure that every month there is income, school fees is paid? You know, you don't want them to be worried about all those. That the fixed property is going to, into the trust for the benefit of the children. Then you decide when it must terminate. The right ages that I've seen is 25. 25, you are assuming at 25 if your life is not in order.
If I'm still feeding my son at 25, we've got problems.
Yes. So you can, like I said, I've seen people pushing it to 35, pushing it to 50 for whatever reasons. But, you know, it needs to be feasible. And the nice part is in your trust, you can actually say, okay, the trustees can exercise discretion. When they see that, okay, your son is 26 now, and actually the money is about depleting, then we can terminate the trust. You don't want it now accumulating cost.
Okay. What is so important to me that you've just said now is it seems like a lot of effort to set this up, and it's necessary to go through that effort. And then it's important, as I mentioned earlier, to go through the exercise of updating it and ensuring that it is at all points current.
Yeah. As current as... If, as we drive out of here, something happens, it must be that current. Maybe on that note, we can touch on what are life-changing circumstances. When do you actually need to change your will?
I'm going through one of those now, so I'm listening.
So the first one is divorce, birth of a child, death of a beneficiary. Maybe you had a will, you had someone, and that person has passed away. Death of a guardian, you've appointed somebody, and then now this person has passed away, you won the lotto. That is a life-changing event because your needs now are completely different. So you need to plan for
it. So you're saying winning the lotto is a life-changing event. How many clients have you had that have come to you having won the lotto?
And what have you advised them?
So there is one person that I know that has won the lotto, and he's still working. He doesn't need to work, but he's still working. And in his view, his children must also work and earn it. But you can see that life didn't change drastically. But now his planning and the relationship that he has with money has changed completely. And I think maybe it's fear of losing it that he's also holding on to his employment. So, you know, those things, they do happen. It becomes a life-changing event because all of a sudden you want a Maserati.
So going through the challenging circumstances that I find myself in now at the moment, I'm having the conversations now that I probably should have had more of over the last 15 years. Past is the past. What is important to me now is to be able to sit down and have a discussion around how my estate needs to be structured in order to ensure that my children are going to be covered for up until the point at which they can support themselves, and how I can do that while they're still minor children with my ex-spouse.
And I think the interesting thing for me, Andrews, is, and I'm interested in your comments on this, is around making sure your ex-spouse is also doing the same thing, because I imagine he's paying maintenance towards the kids.
Yeah.
How do we have those kinds of conversations?
I think it's a tough conversation. I did say it's a tough conversation to talk about money when you're planning to get married. So you can imagine now that you've divorced, it becomes a tough conversation. But remember, we are co-parenting. And what's important when you're divorced is what's in that divorce settlement. Because sometimes I've seen scenarios where maintenance of the surviving spouse, you know, it needs to be catered post your lifetime. So maybe in the divorce settlement, you must look after your ex-husband until whatever happens, you know. Who's going to pay for that? Because then it becomes a valid claim against the estate. So make provision for that. So understand what is in your divorce settlement. And these are some of the things that we need to actually, when we sit with our financial advisors, the minute you say I'm divorced, I want to see what's in there. What's in the divorce settlement? Because, okay, we can talk about, okay, this one has custody of the children. I only see them weekends or whatever. But then who's actually paying maintenance? Who's doing this? Who's doing that? So have a conversation. It's a continuous conversation. Uncomfortable, but you need to have it. Uncomfortable as it is, you need to have it. That's the first one. The second one, yes, you don't have to know. I must share this one. I always share this part. I've seen married people doing a joint will, or we're having a joint discussion around their will, and the following week I'm sitting with the one spouse. Chances are the other one also went to see someone else. It's because the conversation is so uncomfortable and there's trust issues. But when you divorce, I think common ground is the children.
Have you had those conversations?
I haven't had them as much as I should have over the last 15 years, but those conversations are being had now. And if you can't make a decision in the best interest of your children, then that says a lot about you as a person. But you can resolve many issues when it comes down to looking simply at the two children that you have made together and doing what's right for them.
Marwadi, if you had to give like one final statement to everyone listening around this topic, what would it be?
I think let's do the responsible thing. If you are a parent, the responsible thing is to make sure that you leave your children with what you think they deserve. You know, having to see people running around when somebody has passed away, running around from bank to the insurance companies, to the master's office, to the employer, it's very irresponsible, because that's the feeling you're leaving them with. So let's do the responsible thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and you can do the responsible thing. And I think what's also important is just to realize that we don't like talking about death. People have lots of cultural issues, taboo issues, talking about the stuff, dealing with what if I write a will, people may want me dead. At the end of the day, you know, you have an opportunity. You are going to die. That's a reality. Whether it's now, hopefully it's not now, but at some point. So do the right thing and just make sure you've put something in place that makes it easier for your family and the people that you really love. So I want to say thank you very much to Marwadi for a wonderful input. Please, and again to our listeners, I'm going to ask you again to please give us feedback on these topics that we're having. We want to hear from you. What do you want to be hearing about? And how can we help you have those challenging conversations, breaking those taboos around money and death and divorce? And, you know, many of the issues that perhaps we've kind of been raised with. And that is exactly why in our next podcast, we're going to be speaking to a relationship therapist about how to start having these conversations.